Hi, so thanks for having me. This is my first time at PI. I'm very jealous that you work here. Your cafeteria is really good. It's a lot better. I work at a national lab, and your food is a lot better. I'm going to talk about some work with this very clickbaity title we gave it. I think the actual title is something about soft photons, gravitons, and their information content. I am from a high energy background, like a particle physics kind of background, and have sort of slowly started thinking about quantum info, but I don't do ADS-CFT. I haven't given this talk to a properly anointed quantum info group, so if I, you know, if I say something about an S matrix and you don't know what I'm talking about, just please stop me. So this is work with Laurent Chereddin, Dominic Neuenfeld, and Gordon Semenoff. Gordon's a faculty at UBC. I used to be a postdoc there, and those are his students. We have three papers on this. The first one is short and the most dense, but in some way the easiest to read, and I'll mostly be talking about that paper. These are two follow-ups that I won't talk about too much. They're a little more technical. So what I want to talk about is actually very simple in principle, and then it gets a little technical. So the idea is something I hope is non-controversial. So imagine you're going to do an interferometry experiment. So I have some source, and I shoot some beam of particles, sorry, which I'll think of as having a mass, and they go down some beam, and then I have a beam splitter. Again, what I'd like to do is split this thing into some superposition, stick some mirrors or whatever, recombine the thing, do some detection. So what I want to talk about is the following sort of idea. So if you think about what's going on here, if I put some coordinates on this diagram, what I have here is I have a state coming in with momentum in some certain direction. So I have a state that looks like t in the x direction. Okay, now I hit it with the beam splitter, and what's going to happen to that state? Well, naively, you would say, well, it becomes something like 1 over root 2 times the same state, plus something like 1 over root 2 times a state with momentum in the y direction. Okay, and so that's the description that works pretty well. But if you think a little bit harder, you realize, okay, so if this thing has charged particles in it, or more generally, just the fact that it has energy means that there will be radiation emitted here. Why? Okay, because the beam is coming in x and it's coming out in y. Okay, so the accelerated beam causes Bremsstrahlung, which I shouldn't try to spell in real time, but and the Bremsstrahlung. So for the rest of this talk, I'll draw wavy lines. Okay, a wavy line means either a photon or a graviton. So, and it can mean and or. So if I have a charged particle, it'll actually Bremsstrahlung both photons and gravitons. So if you include that in the description, the outgoing state after the beam splitter doesn't look like the simple one-half superposition. You actually have to include the fact that there's radiation on this path where the thing accelerated, and there's a bunch of different possible types of radiation that could come out, and what you have to do is write some coefficients for those amplitudes and sum over them.
There's some amplitude for no emission, right?
Yeah, that amplitude is zero. I'll review why it's zero later, but yeah. There is some. There is an S matrix with.
Zero.
Sorry?
No, very zero.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
In the y direction, is that going up? Why is there gravitons or acceleration in this direction and not in the other one?
Because when you go this way, you didn't accelerate. But if you go this way, you did.
So the acceleration refers to the fact that it changed direction?
Yes.
That's all.
Yeah. Yeah, not acceleration of the lab or something.
So the y direction could be perpendicular to, I mean, it's a horizontal direction still.
It's any direction that's not x.
It doesn't mean you need a gravitational field. This can be flat, right?
Yeah, for sure. This would happen in free space out in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. It's just the gravitational analog of the fact that if I took a charged particle and it's going this way and then I hit it, it'll radiate.
It can't decohere the interferometer, right?
Why not?
Well, it can, and they had these experiments where if you bend electrons fast enough, you lose interference fringes because they radiate. But if you bend them slowly, they can't radiate, I thought. And that's what allows the interferometers to work in the first place.
Yeah, maybe I would say the robust thing is that there are rates of the radiation, and you can engineer them to have slow rates. But in principle, it will always radiate.
It will always radiate.
Okay. Although, in fairness, Okay, so what the point of this talk is going to be is the following set of observations. What is this radiation? It's massless particles in particular. Okay, so what that means is that you can radiate an infinite number. You know, maybe I should say something a little more careful in a people proof theorems in this room. You can radiate an arbitrarily large number of quanta. Okay, by quanta I mean one graviton or one photon. Just divide a fixed amount of energy up into photons. You can do it with as many photons as you want. Just make low energy photons. So of arbitrarily that's different than if the radiation was a massive particle, because then you have to, you know, expend that mass to create it. So this observation, I'll talk about this in a minute. This is the underlying phenomenon that's called the infrared catastrophe. And it says that Hilbert space in a massless gauge theory is a real nightmare. But what I'm going to talk about is this idea. So suppose now I want to do a detection. Okay, so the fact that I have this joint state of the radiation and the beam with some kind of entanglement here means that if I wanted to have a perfectly good visibility in my detector, I need to do some joint measurement on the radiation. But the radiation we're talking about is arbitrarily low energy, so it has arbitrarily long wavelength. So if you have a finite detector resolution, that means that you can't detect all this radiation. And it means you should trace it. And if you trace it, you'll decohere the massive stuff. Or the hard particles is what I'll call them. So in terms of this thing, if you want to say it a little more concretely, if you call these beams, you know, the left beam and the right beam, what I'm saying is that the density matrix element, you're going to measure at sometime t, is going to look like whatever you got after the beam splitter times some function where the function, it decays. And in fact, what I'm going to show, well, the goal here is going to be to calculate, is to prove that this function actually vanishes in the infinite time limit. So in other words, if you waited long enough, this radiation can actually totally distinguish whether your beam went this way or that way. So if you're not measuring it, you're not going to get into any interference between these paths. So that's in the strict infinite time limit. That's because this is a particle physics-y framework where I'm going to use an S matrix in the infinite time limit. I'll talk at the end a little bit about the finite time sort of bootstrapping from the answer. Okay, so the way this talk goes is this is broadly the picture. I'm going to do a much more general version of this, but this is the basic intuition. So to calculate the decoherence, what I want to do is review this infrared catastrophe sort of story, which is from the 30s. Then I'll sort of use that technology to calculate the decoherence rates, and I'll just end with some simple remarks on what it might have to do with anything. So this is a good time for questions at the sort of conceptual level.
The radiation all has to take place within like the amount of time that it's interacting with the beam splitter, doesn't it?
I used to get confused with this, but it's not. So actually, one way to say it is, what the radiation does is it measures you're measuring the Bremsstrahlung part of the radiation, is the fact that the track of the particle changed.
Yeah.
So to make a long wavelength fluctuation of the radiation, you actually have to wait for a time like of order the time it took the thing to go that far.
To go the length of the radiation?
Yeah, to go the length of the whole track. So the radiation, you might think of the radiation as being produced kind of here.
Yeah.
That's not accurate. It's actually produced sort of over the whole time scale of the problem.
Okay.
So in fact, there's a cutoff. So there's a cutoff. So you can only create a photon, you can only Bremsstrahlung a photon of frequency, you know, omega, if you wait a time, you know, where t means the whole time of flight of the particle. This is a property of, like, if you open Jackson chapter 13, it's just in there. I agree, it's a little counterintuitive. T here is going to mean the time of flight of the particle. So, like, from here to here. So because over that entire time scale, what's happening is basically this path and this path are getting more and more distinguishable. Okay, so I have to review the IR catastrophe. So, like I said, this goes back to some very clever people named Block and Nordzik. Did this for QED. And then Steven Weinberg extended this to perturbative gravity. And the treatment I'm going to give follows strongly from Weinberg's book, or you can get it from a paper in 65, I think. Okay, so the notation I'll use for the rest of the talk. Okay, so just to fix the notation I'll use, so for the rest of the talk, this is how I'm going to draw a scattering event. Okay, so the problem in general will be take any scattering event, so these lines mean particles which may have electric charge or not, and definitely have some kind of energy. I draw time running from bottom to top. So this means stuff is coming in, this means some junk happens, a scattering event, and this is the stuff coming out. So the notation is all these lines, you group them up into some index alpha, so this is like a list of momentum and spins of the incoming stuff, charges, whatever other quantum numbers. And the lines up here, I might group them into something similar, beta. So this is a list of, you know, how did I write this? Well, it doesn't matter. It's a similar list of momenta and charges. This is relativistic field theory. I can create particles. I can destroy them, whatever, so the lines don't have to match. There's a constraint that the total energy and momentum of these lines is equal to those. This whole thing, what it is mathematically, is it's just some particle and particle state. Where I have time evolved from past t equals infinity to future t equals infinity from my in state, and I just look at the probability that I got this thing out. Okay, and this is just the S matrix element S beta alpha. I'll keep this up. Okay, so there are a bunch of scales that are going to be all over this problem. Actually, So these are all energy, sorry, they're energy scales. So to define what I mean by low energy or high energy, okay, so one that's important, little lambda, so this is an infrared regulator. So if you want, this is something like a photon or a graviton mass. Okay, so this is something that I'm going to insert into my calculation so that there are no infrared divergences. And then the goal is to take this to zero at the end. So this means that, you know, in an intermediate step in the calculation, I can't produce an infinite number of photons. I produce, you know, some number bounded below because there's a mass gap. another quantity I'm going to need is a big lambda, and this is going to define what I mean by a virtual soft photon. So what I mean here is if I have a Feynman diagram and there's some intermediate virtual state of a photon or a graviton, and its frequency is between my regulator and this cutoff, this is called a soft virtual photon. And then I need to define something similarly for the emission. So a soft emitted photon. So this just means if I have a leg of my Feynman diagram and I actually emit a photon or a graviton and its frequency is between the cutoff, the regulator and this cutoff, it's going to be called soft. So this is roughly speaking my detector resolution.
Virtual soft photon, you're assuming that the virtuality could be spaced out, right? So you're assuming that it's, I mean, a virtual photon.
For the virtual one?
So are you kind of, does that matter?
Yeah, what I really mean by that is that when I wick rotate, it's a little cut off on Euclidean momentum. Although for the very soft things, you know, in the limit that the thing is very, very soft, it's becoming basically real anyway. That is what this infrared divergence is. So
the Coulomb softness is space-like, right?
Well, the Coulomb softness is, I mean, this is an interesting point on its own. I mean, this diagram, the divergence is when this propagator goes on shell. So it's, you know, it's virtual, but the divergence is when it becomes real. So. Okay, so there's a piece of technology that is going to underlie everything I show you here, which goes by the kind of misnomer soft theorem. What this really is just a Taylor expansion. So what it says is, for my purposes, this is a Taylor expansion. So what this says is if I have some S matrix element, and so something is happening, okay, but a photon is emitted. So I have some particle coming out with a momentum p, and it emits a photon or a graviton momentum k. Then in the limit that, so k mu is a vector with, you know, frequency in the time component and some momentum in the space component. So in the limit that this photon becomes zero frequency, this S matrix element factors into a very simple thing. It's just the S matrix element where no photon or graviton was emitted finds something called a soft factor, which just for completeness I'll write. So this is for a photon, this is for a graviton, and the only important property here is A, that there's this factorization, so this is a lot easier than it could have been. I mean, typically if you just add some line in a Feynman diagram, you just have to do a whole other calculation. The other important point is that these have poles as the frequencies are going to zero. So it's a theorem in that sense that this is a leading order in some Laurent series. So you compute this with the photon and graviton momentum in general. You series it out in the momentum, and this is a leading order term. The reason the segregation is useful here is because what you can do is you can actually add any number of emissional events, and then you'll just get n factors of these, and then you can add up all of that, and you just get some exponential. So now I do a slide on the infrared catastrophe. So, like I said, it's not a trivial exercise, but not too hard to convince yourself that you can resum all the soft contributions. Okay. So what I mean by that is the following. So there's two types of soft contributions. So say I take some process, and I look at now all of the possible, you know, photon or graviton loops I can stick between, you know, any of these external legs. They can be overlapping. They can do whatever you want. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to sum. So this is a whole bunch of S matrix elements. Sorry, this is a whole bunch of contributions to the same S matrix element is what's a little more correct. So, you know, I'm looking at the same hard particles, you know, going to the same set of hard particles. I'm just looking for all of the Feynman diagrams that have these loops. And if I sum over all of the loops that have soft contributions, what you can do is you can just write down the answer. This is a very non-trivial fact. Okay, so the answer becomes basically you have the S matrix where all of these loops just don't contribute in the infrared times a factor depending on these scales. Okay, so times some factor of the ratio of the lower cutoff on your loop momenta to your upper cutoff. So, and you know, hopefully it's clear that that's just a corollary of this factorization. Or, well, hopefully you consider it plausible. What does it tell you? It tells you something very interesting. So you can calculate these exponents, A and B. These are the longest formulas I have to write, sorry, but they are important. So so A is a photonic contribution. So what I do is I take the legs of this diagram and I number them 1, 2, and so forth. So all the hard particles in the scattering, and you know that is n is on the incoming and the outgoing stuff. Same with m, and then I take the charges. So it's all, you know, ways of contracting two lines with a photon. I take the product of the charges. I stick in some factors that are plus or minus 1. So this is 1 for an incoming particle, and minus one for an outgoing particle. And then there's a little function that appears here, which depends on, so this function I won't actually write, I can if you want, but it depends just on the relative velocity of the two particles we're talking about. So this is the electromagnetic contribution. There's a similar looking thing for the gravitons, that's B. So this is basically the same, except now what you get are the masses of the lines. And to make it dimensionless, you get the Planck mass squared, same etas, and a different function. And then what's interesting is that you can do a little exercise. It's a little too complicated to do on a board here, to show that these exponents are positive, or they're non-negative. Okay. So what does that mean? What it means is that if you take some process, you calculate all of the infrared divergent parts of all of the loops contributing to the process, you add them up, then what's going to happen is, well, the S matrix actually just goes to zero as I send little lambda to zero. So as I send my photon and graviton mass cut off to zero, you know, this is a positive number to a positive exponent, send the number to zero, you get vanishing. So this is what's really called the IR catastrophe. And this really is a catastrophe if you take it seriously. I mean, this says that the S matrix vanishes in QED. So electrons don't scatter. So.
Unless it's re-scattering. I mean.
Yeah, unless it's forward scattering.
Zero with two run meters.
Right, right. All right, sorry. Yeah, you're right. Electrons only forward scatter. I mean, this would be a real mess. It was true.
I have a question. Is there some interpretation of these FNM, GNM? Like, maybe you don't have to write them out, but is there some, you know, can I think of them as somehow one particle, you know, an effect of one particle propagating in the Coulomb field built up by the other or something like this? Or do you not see any?
Yeah, it's. I have not had an interpretation for them. They're kind of weird looking. I mean, they're like one. You know, F is something like one plus beta times log of one over beta plus one. Yeah.
But presumably the way you construct them is you take two soft factors and integrate over the soft momenta.
That is, yeah, okay.
So
you're right.
That looks like a little bit like it's Coulombic interaction. You know, average of all possible. Exchange.
So yeah, okay. That is true. That is actually the definition of F. Yeah, maybe afterwards we can talk about the. I don't want to try to construct that formula in real time. Okay, cool. Right. So this is a really old problem. This was noticed by. Somebody really old, like I think Heisenberg, calculated the fact that this has a divergence in 1920, and it was solved by Bloch and Nordzig in 1930-something. So the solution is pretty straightforward. The solution is what you're supposed to do now is you're supposed to say, well, this was dumb. I calculated something ridiculous because if, you know, why would I think that I can exactly determine that exactly the set of hard particles came out? What's actually true is that if I have a finite energy resolution, like I said earlier, you know, you should be, you know, honest about your ignorance about how many extra photons and gravitons were emitted. And sort of sum over all the possible, you know, ways of getting something that you thought you got plus maybe like some extra zero energy photon that you didn't look at. So there's two ways to implement this, and I think I'm just going to skip that distinction now, and I'll just tell you about one of them. So So one approach to this that's sort of the more traditional one is you form what's called an inclusive cross-section. So what you do is you say, okay, well, my state comes in, it's got some particle content, a bunch of hard particles. It's important that in this formalism there are no soft things coming in, so all of these lines are going, there's no soft stuff coming in, I just have some set of charges. Okay, and so what does this evolve to? Well, what it really evolves to is a sum over possible hard states, but also a sum over possible radiation, so soft radiation. And there's some S matrix element for all of these various, you know, outcomes. And then I have to do a coherent sum over all of these states. So this is just some exact statement. And then what you do is you say, well, the observable, used in the sense of like something you tell a particle physicist to measure, not like a Hermitian thing, is what's called an inclusive cross-section, or an inclusive rate. So what this thing is this is gonna be the time per unit, the number of certain events, alpha to beta, per unit time, where we allow for an arbitrary set of radiation coming out with energy less than E. So mathematically, that's a sum on soft emission. And then we'll continue to do the sum on the soft loops. So of all of these S matrix elements, so we're now, in addition to allowing for all the loops, I also allow for emission out, you know, that escapes my detector. And what I do is I take, this is an amplitude. I take the amplitude and I take its mod squared to make a probability. And then you just work out what this thing is. Sorry, this looks ugly. And you find a miracle. So what this looks like is this S matrix element mod squared, which is by definition IR finite. This is the one where I cut off all the loops from below. Now, and you multiply it by two factors. Okay, so you get this factor that I had earlier from the loops. Oh, that's A over B plus over 2, sorry. Sorry, A plus B over 2. So when you square it, you get A plus B. Then you get another factor that has to do with the ratio of your detector resolution to this cutoff. And, you know, the miracle is that this thing comes with the exact same power, okay, so that these little lambda things cancel. And so this is finite. I mean, it's lambda independent as I send this cutoff to zero.
Just record your different definitions of your lambdas for lambda.
Yeah, so little lambda is like the photon mass, or the graviton mass, some IR cutoff that is not physical. Big lambda is just an arbitrary thing I say. I'm going to calculate all my loops up to energy big lambda. So it's an RG scale. And big E is like my detector resolution. So it's the amount of total energy I'm allowing to escape in radiation. And so indeed, you get this factor E over lambda, to some power coming out. This is finite, it doesn't care about the cutoff, and that thing is called a Sudokov double logarithm. You can, like, so if you want to, like, compute slack scattering probabilities, you actually have to put that factor in. It's important. It's not zero or one. Okay, but I don't think anybody here does slack data, so thank God I don't have to talk about that. What is important here? Okay, so now what we're going to do is sort of unpack what just happened in the calculation and do something sort of more information theoretic about it. Okay, so you'd barely notice this when you read this description in Peskin and Schroeder, but what you actually really just did here was you did a trace. So what you have is a sum over a whole bunch of states, okay, like this, and all of this sum over soft emission means is take this thing, form a density matrix, and trace on the soft stuff. Okay, so then what you have calculated here, though, isn't the whole density matrix. You've calculated basically the diagonal elements of the density matrix. You've just computed, I mean, these are the probabilities sitting on the diagonal, where the basis I'm talking about is particle momenta. So what happens to the density matrix? Okay. Well, so if you just repeat this calculation, what do you have? Well, you have a state now comes in. It's pure. You know exactly what it is. That's the assumption of the problem. Okay, now what does it become? Some big sum. Okay. So now if I trace all this soft stuff, so I said little b equals little b prime, do the sum, what do you get? You can just do the sum for the same reasons as I've done the sum before, and what you wind up getting is something that looks pretty similar. Where these S matrix elements, again, on the IR finite things, you get some function which is IR finite. It depends on these finite values you've inserted. And then the interesting part is that you get, again, some dependence on this infrared regulator that you want to take to zero. And this is sitting in front of some density matrix element, right? So if I call this whole nasty expression rho hard eta beta prime, okay, what are these density matrix elements describing? So, you know, beta is some set of possible momenta coming out. So if you think about one particle scattering, you know, beta is a momentum, beta prime is a different momentum, or, well, some other momentum. Okay, and the question is, and then, you know, so if you have a beta not equal to beta prime element, you're talking about having a superposition of two momenta coming out of your scattering event. And the question is, which superpositions can you actually have? So, you know, this whole program is saying not all of them, probably, because there's some radiation that we're not measuring, and that should cause decoherence. Okay, so the question is, what superpositions which superpositions survive your limit? And the answer is basically nothing. So a little more precisely, first of all, if beta equals beta prime, so if you're not looking at a superposition, you're talking about just the diagonal of the density matrix, these exponents just go to zero, and then you just recover this answer. If beta is not equal to beta prime, pretty much these exponents are always positive and this thing will always vanish. So it's a little tricky to write down the actual condition. The way it works is the following. Take a two-sphere, a unit two-sphere. Pick any vector that's in the interior. So this is some vector v, you know, whose length is less than or equal to 1. So v means velocity. And then you can define some currents, which I'll write the formula and then tell you what it means. So for each vector, you define a current, one for electromagnetism, one for GR. okay, where what you do is you basically take this direction, this velocity rather, and you ask how much total charge comes out of your scattering event. So, you know, scattering happens somewhere here, you put this big sphere out here, you measure all the particles coming out, you measure their velocity and you measure their charge, and you just count how much, this is the total electric charge coming out with velocity V. There's a similar thing for relativity. Sum over species just means if you have a bunch of different types of charge, you have to sum them up and just make some total number out of it. This looks pretty much the same. You just ask what's the mass coming out. Okay, and then the statement in terms of all that is very clean, but somewhat hard to digest. So with apologies, I'll call this a theorem. The limit, as you send your regulator to zero of these density matrix elements, so which supervision survive? Well, this thing is not vanishing if and only if all of these currents match. So okay, so this is tough to digest. So the current says take a state with a bunch of momenta in it, take that state, take any velocity vector, measure the total electric charge going out in that velocity vector. It's easy to see that a momentum eigenstate will be an eigenstate of this current. So just compute the eigenvalue and then compare those for the two states. Okay, so your state beta and your state beta prime. And if those currents don't match, every single one of those currents, this is an infinite set of currents, if they don't all match, the state is totally gone. It's decohered.
The gravity one, is it really related to the mass or the energy?
Yeah, it's really the, yeah.
Sorry, when you say you're summing over these velocities, if you have a finite number of particles coming out, does that mean there's a finite number of velocities?
In the state, yeah. But so what I'm saying is, so this is just a mathematical, this is just a definition. So I mean, these aren't the velocities in the state. So typically you'd have a state, you know, with a whole bunch of junk coming out, right?
Yeah.
And so now I pick some vector V. Okay, so if V isn't along one of these momentum vectors, you'll just get zero for the current.
Okay.
But if, you know, but you could have like two things coming along in some direction, then I have to add those.
Right. But just when you say that this infinite number of things all has to match exactly between the two betas, the betas both have this, you know, the same number, finite number of particles. Just the V's just enumerate those, accounting for the fact that two particles might be have the same V. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say I think you're saying it right. There's a whole S2 worth of these currents.
Yes.
And you'd have to check every single one on the state. Most of them will be zero.
But like only a finite number will not be zero as long as there are a finite number of out.
That's right. Yeah. So, but in particular, if one state, you know, has a V where one is zero, the current is zero and the other current's not, that state's gone.
Sure.
So, in other words, what this means is that the density matrix is very, very sparse. So, in the momentum basis, what this thing is going to look like is basically a bunch of probabilities, okay, which it had better on the diagonal. Times some Sudikov factors. And then there's basically just a bunch of zeros everywhere else. The only way you can, so sometimes you'll get a non-zero, and so this will look like some process times a different process with a star times you know, some function. Okay, so okay, some things actually do survive. They're very rare. They're measure zero in a precise way. But there are kind of like funny things that, that come out that survive that are worth thinking through. So so an example of a survivor is something silly. So some junk, you throw some junk together, and I ask, okay, can the following superposition survive? So a state where, let's say, one particle is going out with a velocity v, and it has a charge, electric charge q, plus this can actually survive in superposition with a process where I don't have one particle come out, but I have two particles come out, and they just each have half of the electric charge. Something silly. So, you know, it's not totally diagonal. This is not a diagonal element of this matrix.
Are you certain that things like this can survive, or is it just possible that your result is equal to that?
So if you can...
Because there are these extra sort of, you can have these sort of collinear divergences and things like this. I mean, roughly this would correspond to two particles coming out of your scattering experiment, you know, going exactly, you know, sort of going exactly parallel to each other. But if you go to the restroom, you know they're going to sort of attract each other, and then some other thing is going to happen.
Oh, well.
It's slightly different directions.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, this is a...
Maybe, you know, even this loophole might be pluggable. I don't know if we've thought about it.
We have thought about it a little. I mean, you're right that this state is bogus, because these things will... I mean, it's like two charges sitting right on top of each other. I mean, what does that mean? One thing that we're pretty sure it doesn't, so something more sophisticated that would survive would be if you had just some internal quantum number in the particles. So these particles carry, I don't know, isospin or something. And you can have a superposition of one isospin with a different one. And that's, all of what I just said is totally insensitive to that.
This would be like an exact global symmetry or something.
Yeah. Any charge that's not electric or mass.
I think what we're saying is if you look at the proof of the LHCb theorem, that is the regime in which you can assume this matrix.
Well, that's...
You have to assume that the states you're looking at is sparse, that is, it cannot contain this, or the supports of this, of the wave functions on.
Stuff like this, yeah.
In fact, in the mere definition of the outside of the existence matrix, you cannot have such things.
I see. Yeah, maybe.
Because You
need
to get, anyway,
wave
packets. They have to have
non-overlapping. Yeah, that's right.
Momentum space. Anyway.
Fair enough.
It's kind of, it's not even possible.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, what I really mean here is, I guess, I mean, the exponents A vanish for this. So, okay, good. All right, so... Yeah, so this is like a rather formal calculation, but I want to stress that the intuition here is actually pretty straightforward in the sense of the following. So what's going on is I have a bunch of stuff coming in, and I have a bunch of stuff coming out, and basically, you know, the total charge here, in some sense, there's acceleration of charges happening. Okay, and so what's going on is, as any scattering process will, you know, create, you know, radiation, okay, and the radiation of the different processes is different. And so the point of this calculation is really just saying that, well, if you wait for an infinitely long time, you know, you have this infrared divergent tail of the radiation spectrum, and what that's telling you is that if you actually waited for an infinite time, the radiation fields are capable of totally distinguishing basically any set of outgoing particles. And what they do in particular is these radiation fields measure the sort of velocities coming out of your process. The velocity is what determines the radiation field. So that's sort of the central result of at least the first paper we wrote. I mean, the other papers sort of just back up this picture and a different formalism that people kept harassing us about on email, where you dress the particle states with radiation, but I don't think people here will care so much. There's some remarks about this that I think should be made. So sort of what are the implications for this? So one obvious thing is, in real life, okay, so, you know, say you're at the LHC, people always ask me, okay, well, what the hell are you talking about? You know, we scatter charges at the LHC, and, you know, if you think about what this density matrix says, it says something like, well, this is momentum space. So I have basically a diagonal density matrix in momentum space. Take the Fourier transform of this. It's just totally delocalized in space. So, you know, how does that work? Or, you know, how is it that we can do interferometry experiments and we don't have this, like, complete destruction of the superposition every time we do it? The answer is simple and boring. It's just that this is at finite time. So like I have said at the beginning, the duration of your experiment puts a cutoff. On the radiation spectrum.
So I don't think they measure. There's no two space experiments in Vinci.
Yeah,
it's
well.
It's a particle of physics, so it's always the extent state of this classical space. Right? So it would be interesting to go and have an Lichy type detector which can. I don't think anybody has ever done superpositions of relativistic particles.
No.
Detection for that.
Yeah, okay, so let me be more precise about this. So you can make a finite time prediction and it looks like something like the following. So if I, just to do my simple example with the beam splitter. So let's say the beam splitter acts at t equals zero. If you actually sort of work this out, finite time, oops, sorry. You can work out that the density matrix coming out of this thing, so L again means one branch of this thing, R means the other, and you want to look at the visibility of this thing. This will look like whatever you got at the beam splitter, and then I should put a squiggle because this means to like leading order in low energy Bremsstrahlung. There's other decoherence, but the function looks like the momentum of the particle in units of the Planck momentum. Plus its electric charge times its log, where I put in all the dimensional factors. So this thing is very nearly equal to one for anything we could think of that's realistic. Certainly where I should have said M Planck times C is of the order of a kilogram per times meter squared. That's an enormous momentum to shoot through a beam splitter. It would break any beam splitter I'm aware of. So, you know, nevertheless, you could imagine trying to do something like this. So, you know, I think there's something like what Laurent is saying, you know, especially with the charge, you can sort of play around with these parameters and imagine at least the electrically charged scenario, you know, seeing an effect from this. The problem is just that you have to wait a very long time because it's sitting in this log. And then I just want to make one more comment on the black hole information problem, because that's some non-zero fraction of why we started this work. So in terms of the black hole problem, okay, so this is really sort of Andy Strominger was the first person who said this publicly that I'm aware of. This is just a proposal. It's very vague. So the idea is the following. You want to make a black hole. So what do you do? Well, you take a pure state of some matter, okay, and you organize it so that it's very likely to form a black hole, and you let time run forward. And then what Hawking says is that the black hole will form, evaporate, and then give you some density matrix that looks thermal, okay, at the outgoing state. And this is no good, or people think this is no good. Okay, time evolution isn't reversible, which I guess is important to some people. I don't know why it's so important, really. But okay, so this is Hawking's idea. People have been complaining about it for a long time. So what Andy said was, maybe what happens is actually the state is not thermal. It's actually some pure state that looks like a sum of some stuff. Okay, where just super schematically, where there's product states, some product states where. His proposal is that these are the products of the soft stuff and the hard stuff. So in other words, you have your black hole, it's produced from a pure state, and then it decays into some sum of pure states. It's just that on each branch of the decay product, there's this soft radiation that you can't actually look at. And the soft radiation is definitely not taken into account in any, in any calculation from the black hole evaporation I've ever seen. And the proposal is just that maybe you can rig this up such that if you trace the soft stuff, you get the thermal density matrix back out for the hard stuff. Okay. This gets people fired up. All I want to say about this is that I think what we're doing is consistent with this picture. What is true is that, in a general scattering calculation, you do have an outgoing state that looks kind of like this. You have soft stuff correlated to hard stuff, and, this whole talk was about the fact that if I trace the soft stuff, I'll get some diagonal density matrix. What's not obvious and would not follow from what we did is that you would get a thermal density matrix. So, getting the Boltzmann coefficients, that would require some real, non-perturbative quantum gravity kind of calculation that we aren't attempting here. But nevertheless, what we're doing maybe lends some very light weight to this kind of proposal. Yeah, good. I'm right on time. Thanks.
About detection. Here you say, I agree with you, the type of experiments that we do today, nobody really worried about propositions. We don't really need this. But, can you think about designing next generation of experiments, like particles, that somehow depends on the subtleness factor? That we, multi particle state, I don't know what you say about that. But,
yeah, I mean.
What is the next step in
revamping
particle physics?
That's all part of
physics. Yikes.
that's the next level, right? So far, particle physics has been ignored. So,
there's two things to say. One would be, a conservative particle physics statement is that they've measured the soft stuff a lot, and that's in the sense of if you look up the particle data guide, and they'll actually report you the S matrix squared times this E over lambda factor.
So in their case, what's the number?
It's a cutoff you insert by hand, and then when you actually estimate this thing with the theory, you have to the big lambda dependence cut in principle cancels here. In practice, it's an RG scale you do by hand. I just want to point out that this factor.
So it should cancel.
this thing has been measured, so like, and it comes from these calculations. That said, on the, I mean, the superposition thing, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it would be very cool to measure the photonic decoherence, and possible. I mean, if you put numbers into that, that's not outlandish. Measuring decoherence from graviton bremsstrahlung would be striking.
Could you find new massless particles by the effects of their bremsstrahlung?
If they couple strongly, yeah, that's true. That's an interesting idea.
But it would be higher momentum divided by the mass.
It's also generally a pretty weak effect in the sense that it depends on how long you can keep the thing. Well, it's a decoherence question, right? You know, how long can you keep the thing superposed in the first place? And then your sensitivity is sort of, well, I don't know if you want to call it logarithmic or linear in time, but it's not great. It's not like T-squared, like a collisional decoherence.
But I think here, you're, I mean, okay, you're still mentioning like particle physics, like where it's one particle, but what if I would be more like, you know, I have n object like scattered. So how does it scatter with the mass? And, I mean, the kilogram is big for one particle, but for, you know, or a gram, if I get this more.
Yeah, that's right.
What if I do some version of particle physics and study, you know, like they scatter a lot of things together?
Yeah.
There should be, you know, visible if it adds up with a specific amount.
Yeah, we could talk a little, you know, offline with about numbers and stuff, but yeah, I mean, the kind of system, you're always going to be fighting the mass of your object over the Planck mass, and if you want to put something in superposition, getting to the Planck mass is hard, but not totally implausible anymore. So the Planck mass in real units is 10 to the negative 5 gram or something. So, you know, putting a microgram in a cat state is not space age anymore. I mean, it's you can't do it yet, but it's, people are sort of seriously discussing this now. So, you know, maybe you can do something.
Okay, they're not inside.